My name is Ari Alanis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, we will have part two of our interview with the president of NYU, John Sexton, and continue to discuss the impact that religious communities can have on the Global Network University. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and now to the continued conversation with President Sexton. I'm curious about balancing this ecumenism with, let's say there are, I mean, we know that there are many religious traditions that have an exclusive truth component and that do believe you have to either do a certain set of things or accept a certain set of beliefs to attain salvation. And so how does one believe that and stay true to that belief while also accepting a certain level or of ecumenism? I know we have a lot of students at NYU who would say that the only way to attain a spot in heaven or some sort of eternal salvation would be by accepting a certain type of, a certain perspective on Jesus or a certain, you know, you could find an analog within a number of religions. So how does someone in that camp then approach ecumenism in a way that is both true to that belief but also can be functional and accepting in a multi-faith context?
So, look, it's not just people at NYU that run across that spectrum. Right. There are people in my family that run across that spectrum, and probably more people in my family that are on the side of the spectrum that believes that there's a certain set of doctrines that one has to believe in order to be saved, that are very close to the old extra ecclesia and the lasalis notion that outside the church there's no salvation. And, you know, outside the church was the Catholic version in Latin, but there's a, as you say, a parallel version in virtually every institutional religion. So how do I engage in dialogue with such people? Part of it is that part of the ecumenical instinct is a dialogue is not some kind of Hegelian conversation where there's a thesis and an antithesis and it, you know, leads to a synthesis and a compromise position. This is not a negotiation, but it's a genuine putting of oneself into the perspective of the other person. It's not even, Hannah used earlier the kind of view of the process as comparative. It's not even comparative in that sense. Mm-hmm. It's a genuine movement of self into the other perspective to derive from it as much of the view of the other person as you can. It doesn't mean accepting the other person's view. Now, in the primitive versions of ecumenism in the 60s, it was interesting the way ecumenism played out because it wasn't the grand movement that my mentor made by embracing the spirituality of 25 faith traditions. It was, can we as Roman Catholics get together and negotiate off the table certain doctrinal differences with the Anglicans? Yeah. I remember one of my teachers at the time pointing out to us that, you know, if you have A and B and C and D lined along a doctrinal spectrum on some, does make any difference what doctrine, and if A and B get together and move to some common position that brings them closer together, in the process of that, B has moved farther away from C if C hasn't moved. And so the process of coming together in one part of the spectrum created distance. But that was a very narrow view of what ecumenism was. It was very different from what I've just described, mm-hmm. which is, you know, let me understand what B and C and D are all saying in a genuine way. You also don't necessarily end up in a, well, we all just agree to differ on this. Tucked away, and this was the brilliance of the intellectual move that my mentor, Ewart Cousins, made with his work, tucked away in virtually every one of these doctrinal, you see, because what you're focusing on with your question are the doctrinal mm-hmm. manifestations of religion.
Yeah.
It is this notion that the genuine truth is ineffable, is incapable of being reduced to cognitive terms, notwithstanding the Nicene Creed. Okay, there is in Christianity from the beginning a powerful lesson that, yeah, doctrines take us so far, but the real truth can't be put into words any more than the mystery of love can be put into words. So if that's the case, and that's in all of these doctrinal traditions, then there's an inherent warning in the doctrinal traditions. Be careful about getting too literalist. Now, look, fundamentalism is also a manifestation in every religion, including in baseball, right? So this doesn't deprive the fundamentalist of the unassailable to that person's belief. I mean, if you start off with the idea that there is an anthropomorphic interventionist God who is the designer and manager, because the intervention continues, of creation, who then gave us a revelation. You see, this is the interesting thing about the Abrahamic mm-hmm. religions, not only the Abrahamic religions, but they all believe there was a revelation. Now, some people believe that that revelation was actually this anthropomorphic interventionist God dictating to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So each word, even the errors of language, get taken extremely seriously by the hyperliteralists. And you have this world, and a day means a day to the hyper-literalist, not necessarily the hyper-literalist. Even the nuns in the 50s told us, well, a day could be a million years. To the hyper-literalist, you're now down to, you know, creationism, right? And you can't move from that. Because it's not for you. Truth is not something to be... Truth in this area, this is what I was taught in the 50s, you know, truth was not something we sought. You know, this whole notion of the modern research university, I remember when I went to Abu Dhabi to teach for the first time, and I was going to teach not the NYU students, but the Emirati students, because we started teaching them before we started teaching the NYU Abu Dhabi students. So these were all local Emirati college students, all of whom were Muslim. And I remember meeting with my class here, because it was the same syllabus here and there, and saying to my students here, I'm very nervous about this, because I don't know, I've never taught students like these, or at least what they might be. I didn't know what they were. I hadn't met them yet. I said, they may be where I was heuristically and intellectually in the 50s, where truth was not something to be sought. The whole notion of developing critical reasoning and so forth, you know, it had its use in certain fields. But when it came to the big stuff, sorry, we get that from the big guy who handed it down and dictated it, whether it's to the Pope or, you know, to the prophet or to Moses or whatever. And, you know, you don't touch that. You don't need to investigate that, because it's infallibly given to you from above. Now, it was fascinating. I have outside of the room in which we're sitting a poem that was written by one of the first women in that class over in Abu Dhabi, as a gift to me at the end of the year, in which she talks about how each week, after argument and debate, she would draw a crooked line in the sand between what was right and what was wrong, what was acceptable and what was not, only to erase it and draw it again after further argument and debate. Now, this was not what I was expecting when I thought, but there are people in the world who are not like Salama. And they're in all the faiths. And their view is unassailable, even in an ecumenical dialogical process. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean they can't be engaged in an ecumenical dialogical process. And maybe through the increased awareness of the doctrinal statement of ineffability, whether it be the 100th name of Allah or the pronunciation of Yahweh's name or whatever, that there is the real reality, they can be brought to say, okay, maybe there's convergence around what we call spirituality, which is where my mentor came with his publication.
I just have a question about tolerance. This has made me think. I'm really interested to know your thoughts on this moment when, especially in the United States, when these people that are maybe more doctrinal and more tied to this kind of solid set of ideals, are we supposed to tolerate their intolerance? So this is a question that obviously has arisen with issues of, you know, same-sex marriage, anything related to the LGBTQ community. I think also you could talk about it in terms of race. And that moment when you, I think you really need to say, I'm sorry, but I don't tolerate your intolerance. That's just not okay. I don't care if it's in your doctrine. So I was just wondering if you could kind of speak to that.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court, in my mind, a bit disingenuously in addressing this issue came first in a case called Reynolds versus the United States, which was a disgraceful case that authorized essentially religious discrimination against the Mormons in the 19th century, but then in more respectable cases returned to this concept of the distinction between belief and action. And in the Supreme Court's words, you know, you're entitled to believe anything you want. It's when you convert it into action, and action might be the speaking even of what you believe, that there are limitations placed upon you by the norms of society. I've always found that a bit disingenuous, because what does it mean to give me the freedom to believe something if I can't say what I believe?
Especially at a university.
Yeah. So I don't want to rest solely on that, but it's an interesting place to start the conversation in answer to your question, Hannah. No, I don't think that the ecumenical spirit requires us to give permission to everybody to say whatever they wish, even when that violates the common norms of secular society as we've created it. And one of the common norms of secular society, at least in the United States and hopefully spreading in the world, but at least in the United States, is the equality of humankind and the inherent right of humankind to manifest their personhood as it is. And without discrimination, you know, based upon that. And there are certain norms and bounds of the ecumenical dialogue, one of which is civility and respect. So I can name and shame, and you know, not every... I don't like to use the word tolerance so much, because it collapses very quickly into everybody's entitled to their own opinion. And there are some opinions people aren't entitled to, such as the world is flat. I mean, now people can choose to isolate themselves in ignorance, and there are people that believe the world is flat. But the boundaries of ecumenical dialogue don't take me so far as to have to take those people seriously. Now, to come back to your question, that same kind of logic for me operates to bound, so to speak, the ecumenical conversation in a way that allows me to shame people who have views that are outside the norms of the common secular society.
I guess I'm thinking specifically now, this made me think of I can't remember which state it was in, I think maybe Texas, one of the judges who said that she wouldn't sign marriage contracts after the Supreme Court decision because it was against her religious beliefs.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a very specific kind of example of what I'm kind of trying to figure out.
Yeah, and the county clerk that refused to do that had a choice, you know, to preserve her conscience, which was to resign her office. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But as long as you're in your office, that's a pretty easy, a pretty easy one to figure out.
Yeah,
because once the process has run its course in secular society, and the norms of the Constitution have been clarified by the Supreme Court as they were, you know, then, you know, frankly, it's not a penalty to say to you if you take the oath as you take your office to uphold the law of the United States, then, you know, you've chosen to say, I will follow. And if you don't want to follow, that's fine. But don't demand that we continue to pay you to do, you know.
Right.
But there are tougher cases than that. Look, all universal principles ultimately collapse against the counterexample. So even the purity of dialogue in the sanctuary of the university over issues has exceptions, you know. And do we let everybody speak, even if they are the kinds of viewpoints that you describe? I don't think the purity of the sanctuary has to go that far.
No.
I mean, now, does this get into difficult questions of boundary setting? Yes. But that's something that comes with trying to create a community.
So I know we only have a few more minutes, but I want to finish on, you touched on a word, ineffable, before, and I know that in your class and even in the introduction to this podcast, I've used the phrase effing the ineffable as a description of
effing now that's a dangerous way to put it.
Effing the ineffable as a way of as part of the complexity of putting language to things that are ineffable and trying to bring that in. So I'm curious whether as someone who has been talking about religion, talking to people who are religious for many years in a university, what do you think what are we doing well in universities right now, and what do we need to do better? What can we, or at least me, as someone who works with religious groups every day, what are kind of the next things that we have to be doing better and working on to make the universities better?
Well, I have to say, couple of quick thoughts on this, because it's interesting the way you put the question. So right now there are 5,000 roughly colleges and universities in the United States, and about 1,500 to 2,000 are private, principally tuition driven, with very few exceptions for the high endowment schools, colleges and universities. And I was the chairman of the American Council on Education, as such, responsible for thinking about all of that symphony orchestra of various higher education institutions, because it really is a very, very different and diverse set of institutions. You think about the two with which I've been associated, for example, they couldn't be more different. You know, NYU, which is a complex, huge, global, private research university, St. Francis College in Brooklyn, you know, which, you know, all of its students came by subway. They all shared a faith, or at least were willing to be educated in the context of a faith. And the idea was teaching and empowering, not research, whatever. I've said publicly that I think of the 1,500 privates, there probably will only be about 500 that will exist 20 years from now. But of those 500, a significant number will be faith-based, because that will be a value proposition that will attract parents and students to pay tuition, because they want to be educated in the context of their faith. That's the story of America, and the parallel religious school system to which 15% of students in America go in primary and secondary education. And I think there will be a parallel. The challenge, of course, will be to those private universities like NYU that are not faith-based. What is the value proposition that would cause a person to come to a university like NYU? And you have to have a clear idea of what that is if you're an NYU. And thankfully, I think we have a pretty clear idea of what it is. We've talked about some of the elements today. But, you know, you start thinking about universities that like LIU or Pace or, you know, big private universities that are not faith-based, and the challenge to them is to come up with a value proposition. The Jesuits would call it a ratio studiorum. Now, I think within the faith-based schools and within NYU, and within NYU, I have to say, the work that you're doing, things are pretty good. I mean, I find a tremendous ecumenical spirit here that runs across the spectrum from the religious manifestations of ecumenism to the more secular progressive manifestations of ecumenism that we've been talking about this morning. There's not a lot of fault I can find, you know, with the way this is playing out at NYU. I think it's quite remarkable and singular among secular universities that there is as much attention as there is to this ecumenical dialogue. And I think it's because of the natural loop that comes through the Global Network University and the fact that that has been a vehicle around the world for building the stature of NYU. So about 3 years ago, if a student takes the SAT and has their scores reported to schools, that's very easy for the SAT folks to track. Mm-hmm. And you can ask the SAT of X percent, the top 20% of test takers. We know they applied to us. What other schools were of interest to them? And for the first time 3 years ago, with students outside the United States, NYU became the number one school of interest, surpassing Harvard, which had been the number one school of interest for top students. And that's in part an incident, a collateral of the Global Network University and the fact that we're out there looking for outstanding students. And it's had ramifications here in New York. People might think of it having ramifications in Abu Dhabi and Shanghai, where it does. But in New York now, north of 20% of the entering class, it's getting close to 25% of the entering freshman class, I'm not talking about graduate students, come with foreign passports. And that's without us intentionally looking to do that. They get no plus factor. They're just, on the merits, the top students. So when you have that many students, for example, in my religion and government class this semester, the plurality religion is Hinduism. And last year, in my religion and government class, was the first time in the 25 years I've taught it to freshmen here at NYU that I didn't have a single Jewish student.
That's even more surprising, actually.
Yeah. So, I think there's a selection bias there because I think foreign students, if given the opportunity to take a course with the president of the university, right, are more likely to do it. Yeah, I mean,
we had a student from Abu Dhabi in the baseball class when I took it.
That's right. So the very presence of the different perspectives, mm-hmm, in a secular sense, not in a religious sense, although there's usually a collateral tracing, as I reveal with the Hindu, mm-hmm, statement of that. So it is. So ecumenism has become a reality in the dorms at NYU. It's become a reality in the classroom at NYU. It's, you know, and it's not just for the students in Abu Dhabi, where the plurality contingent is the American contingent at only 15%. Now think of that. 15% of the class is American, and that's the largest contingent,
wow,
in the NYU Abu Dhabi class. and genuinely from every sector of society of 112 countries in a student body that's only 1,000. So, I mean, you're living daily in the cafeteria the life of ecumenism. Well, think of NYU Shanghai, where, yes, 50% of the class is Chinese. But the day they arrive, every Chinese student has a non-Chinese roommate. So this is a reality of ecumenism. So it's not just the inter-religious stuff that you're doing, but this is such a part of this the DNA now of NYU that I think to call NYU the first ecumenical university is not an overstatement at all. And I have to say I'm pretty satisfied with where we are. Now, it's still this whole notion of this DNA for our university is in its young adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's going to be fun for me to just sit back over the next, I hope, decade or more and see what people like you and, of course, our extraordinary new president, Andrew Hamilton, do with this and what the faculty does with it. But I mean it's well launched, and my imaginations about what it can be are now irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm not a triumphalist, I don't really even have a stake in where it goes. I hope that we don't give up on the quixotic bet in favor of ecumenism and a mm-hmm. community of communities. I think that would be a tragedy because, as for example, the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Dan Gillerman, said to me when I approached him about NYU Abu Dhabi, and he said, not only must you do this, but NYU uniquely should do this, because you are what you are. You are in and of the first city in the world that has gotten this well. And if NYU doesn't do this, the university that's best situated to do it will have failed at the effort. And we as humankind can't afford to fail at the effort. I mean, that's the bottom line for me. So, I'd rather end by expressing my deep satisfaction with where we are and to encourage, the two of you to go onward and upward. You may not do it as the Jesuits taught me to do it, ad maiorem Dei gloriam, for the greater glory of God, because you may have some other language in which you'd like to put it, and you may have some other definition of God. But you should do it in the teleology of a hope for a greater humanity.
Well, I think that's a great place to end on. Thank you very much for spending so much time with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Thank you to President John Sexton for joining us on this week's podcast and for dedicating so much time in his busy schedule to talking about religion and spirituality with us. A special thank you to his entire staff for helping coordinate this. We know it was not easy with the schedule. Special thank you, as always, to Brian Young, who helped produce, edit, and really just do everything for the podcast. Also, thank you to Liz Suados, whose music is originally from the Of Many film. Thank you to other people in the office who helped out, especially to our student worker, Hannah, whose voice you heard during the podcast and who helped me with the interview. And lastly, please rate and review us on iTunes. If you have any thoughts, comments, questions, suggestions, or anything for the podcast that you'd like us to do, please email us at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. It comes directly to me. We'd love to talk to you about it. If you're someone who does multi-faith and has always dreamed of appearing on a podcast, then we've dreamed of hosting you. So please send us an email, and we'd love to set up a time to talk. Until next week's episode, this is Ari Otness.